hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Classicist is Victor Davis Hansen, the Morton and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you recently had a piece in the print edition of National Review, the title of which asked a question that Americans have been asking themselves for a while, and probably more acutely over the past couple of decades. Must America be in the Middle East? And before we turn to the contemporary analysis of that question, I want to start with the historical case. You make an interesting point in here that for a long time, the Middle East really was sort of a peripheral concern when it came to foreign policy. And what really changed that was the Cold War. So give us an understanding of how and why the calculus changed during those years.
Yeah, well, remember that in antiquity, it was the sea in the middle of the land, middle terra, the three continents of Asia, Africa, and Europe. But once with the discovery of the New World, it became kind of a trapped lake. In other words, any country in the Mediterranean that didn't have an Atlantic port never really developed sophisticated technology to get to North and South America or go around the Cape Horn. There were galley countries like Venice or the Papal States, but Spain, France, Britain, and the Netherlands, they were beneficiaries. And then, of course, the Protestant Reformation and Islam. The Ottomans were constantly in the Mediterranean threatening those countries where the countries on Western Europe. And that's a long explanation to explain why the Mediterranean became of secondary importance. But after World War II, with the discovery of oil and the rise of the Soviet Union, it was one of the agendas of global communism to get control of the Middle East, not only to get its wealth, but to deny oil-dependent economies in Europe and the United States that precious resource. So the Soviet Union was backing all of these pan-Arabic and Ba'athist movements, and everybody from Nasser to Gaddafi to the Assad family in Syria. But what has changed is that a couple of things have changed. Actually, a lot of them have changed. One is that the United States is now the largest producer of natural gas and oil in the world. And we don't really need that oil. And the people who do need that oil are mostly the Chinese, and they take about 45% of it. And the Europeans, and we got to remember, the EU is the largest importer of oil in the world, even more than China, who that has about 5 million barrels a day it produces. And so in our calculations, it's sort of, well, we don't need the oil, but if we have to go in there to make sure that others get the oil, who are those others? There are enemies, the Chinese, and there are friends, the Europeans, but our friends won't frack on their own soil when they have sizable amounts of natural gas, and they won't build a navy to protect their own sea lanes. So it becomes a hard sell to the American public to subsidize that. And then, especially because we don't need it. And then Israel, vis-a-vis the Arab world, has never been in such a stronger position. That was one of the reasons that we were so engaged in the Middle East, to protect this fragile democracy in a sea of hostile neighbors. But now Israel's crafted this very unusual, almost surreal alliance with most of the Arab nations, with a few exceptions, against Iran, and the Palestinians are no longer a cause celeb in the world. I mean, people are sort of tired of them as perpetual 75-year-old refugees. So there's been a lot of radical changes in the area, and there's no more Soviet Union, of course. And it makes it very difficult that the United States would ever, to envision that the United States would ever send an expeditionary force of the size comparable to what's now in Afghanistan, or maybe what we saw in the first and second Gulf Wars. We have interests, but they're not the same, and they're limited in the region.
It's really the thrust of this piece as we read the different examples that you give. It's not that we should just wash our hands of it, not be engaged, but the interest is at a smaller level than it was before. And I want to ask you about one of the criteria by which we judge that, which is sort of great power rivalries. I mean, Russia has interests in the Middle East. China has interests in the Middle East. To what extent should those interests unsettle us? And how do you judge China and Russia's conduct there in terms of advancing their own interests?
Russia's interest, it doesn't need the oil. And history, recent history suggests that people who get involved in there, and they're involved in Syria, don't come out in a cost-benefit analysis very well. But their primary reductionist policy is whatever we want, they're opposed. So we want Assad gone, apparently, and we want stable, moderate governments, and they don't, like, their attitude is, well, if the United States wants it, we don't want it, and we'll try to thwart them to make life more difficult for a variety of other reasons. And so that's one criterion. But more importantly, China wants the oil, and they, like Russia, wouldn't mind the oil being cut off to U.S. allies, particularly Europe. And how does that translate on the ground is they tend to promote Iran because they have no resonance with the Arab world anymore. Only those Arab regimes like Yemen or Syria or terrorist organizations like Hezbollah that are subservient to Iran. And our interests are essentially no single hegemon in that region should have a monopoly on the oil, whether it was Saddam Hussein in the 80s and 90s or whether it's Iran now, so that they don't have inordinate power that oil revenues would produce. And we don't want a terrorist al-Qaeda type enclave or a caliphate or anything like that. So ISIS enclave, we don't want territory carved out to launch attacks like 9/11. Other than those two strategic concerns, I don't think that, again, it justifies a large U.S. ground presence in the region.
So what kind of presence and what kind of resources does it justify? If these are sort of the things that you're concerned about, trying to make sure that there's not a widespread expansion of terrorism or a growing hegemonic state like Iran, what does that dictate in terms of what American resources in the region should look like?
I think we have about 5,000 ground troops in Iraq, maybe a little bit more when you count in Syria. And that's probably the maximum that the American people will warrant. And then we probably, if you count, use that term greater Middle East, things like air bases in Turkey or the ground troops in Afghanistan, we probably have almost 90,000 troops. But that's a very fragile status quo, because I don't think there's any support for increasing the amount of soldiers in Afghanistan. We have about 12,000 now, I guess. They've been there for 19 years. And so I don't think that anybody believes they're going to have a strategic resolution. It's more or less, let's try to do something like Korea and keep Americans there forever, and then maybe they'll wear out the Taliban, or at least allow this government in Afghanistan to liberalize and become viable. And I don't think even people trust that strategy. But what I'm getting at is, I think we've reached the maximum number of troops available in the Middle East, and it's going to decline. And you can see the symptomology of that when Trump does not want to get involved in a shooting war between NATO allied, sort of ally, Turkey and the Kurds, and he's met with outrage. But had he gone in there and sent in 2,000 or 3,000 more troops as people wanted, then the rationale would, he could do that all over the Middle East. There's just as many fault lines as before. But that's not who he was. He ran on not doing that and allowing some damage to be done to people who are neutrals or our friends, if that's what the cost was, without losing deterrence. There was always contradictions in his Middle East policy, and that is, I don't want to be there, but I'm a Jacksonian, and I believe in establishing deterrence so they don't attack American civilians or American sailors or airmen. And that means that if you want to restore deterrence, you have to use military force if need be. If you use military force, you're by definition engaged. And how he threaded that needle or squared that circle was, he redefined commitment is mostly, I think, air power and sea power. And that's when I think that's what he meant when he said, I have 52, I guess that was timed or synchronized with the number of hostages that were finally released from Iraq. I have 52 targets in Iran, and if you kill any Americans, I'm going to systematically go down that list. And the subtext was their power stations, nuclear facilities, air bases, who knows? And they're not going to cost any American lives. They can be taken out by drones or cruise missiles, probably.
You mentioned the salience of oil having declined some because it mooted for the United States purposes anyway by fracking and our development of our own energy resources. That said, there is still a more general version of that argument that an important role for a superpower like the U.S. to play is to make sure that important trade routes like the Suez Canal or the Straits of Hormuz stay open for global commerce. How much stock should we put into arguments like that, Victor? By which I mean that the U.S. bears this distinctive responsibility to ensure, you know, what are essentially international benefits. Should we be looking for more international assistance in terms of shouldering that burden?
That's a very good question, Troy, because we're seeing something analogous with the coronavirus scare in China, because it's almost shut down Chinese tourism entirely. It'll cut off most trade and visitation to China. And what effect will that have on the global economy? I don't know what the percentage in GDP losses will be worldwide, but it will have an effect. But it's beyond the control of the United States. And the worst thing we can do is have business as usual to China until we know the nature of this virus. The same thing is true of oil. Should Iran send a whole armada of drones and take out four or five oil refineries in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and reduce Middle East, you know, daily output by 50%, that would have an effect on the economy. But to what degree the United States, it's insulated from that. To what degree does it calibrate? Well, it's going to hurt China and it's going to hurt Europe, and then they're not going to buy U.S. goods, or it's going to affect U.S. tourism, or it's going to affect financial markets. I don't know, but I do know that the American people do not think any longer, 75 years after World War II, that it's our sole responsibility to keep protecting the financial and economic interest of other people who are not necessarily always fond of us.
So my final question for you, there's a passage in your piece that's really stark in its comprehensiveness. Our listeners are just going to have to forgive me a long quote here because it's the only way to do it justice. You write in here, and I'm quoting, "Especially in the last half century, the Middle East has produced little more than bad news, bad memories, and bad blood. Six major Israeli-Arab conflicts, the 1979 and 80 Iranian hostage crisis, the Persian Gulf War, the Iraq War, a decade of no-fly zones, the shooting down of a U.S. Black Hawk in Mogadishu, the two-decade slog in Afghanistan, the first and second Libyan bombing missions, the Marine barracks attack in Beirut, the Khobar Towers bombing in Saudi Arabia, the terrorist attack on the USS Cole in Yemen, Obama's red line in Syria, gassings and genocides by Saddam and Assad, the hijackings, assassinations, mass killings and bombings by the Muslim Brotherhood." This keeps going. "The PLO, Black September, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS, the current mass ethnic cleansing of Christians, the online beheadings, the no-go zones of Middle East immigrant communities in Europe, all these have done their part in souring generations of Americans on the Middle East." I mean, good Lord, Victor, when you read that list in its entirety, at the risk of asking a question that admits of no easy answer, what is wrong with this region? That is an arresting catalog of dysfunction and malfeasance. To what do we point as the underlying malady or maladies, as the case may be?
Yeah, you know, and then you think of those names, don't you? Zarqawi, Zawahiri, Bin Laden, Gaddafi, Assad.
Whoa, which I didn't get to because I didn't want to fatigue everyone. But yes,
no,
they're right there.
Baghdadi. I know. It's an emotional response now with Americans. They're just done with it. You know, been there, done that. And what is the problem with that region? Economically, that it's sort of like the homeless in San Francisco next to Google and Apple and Facebook. There's an enormous amount of wealth, and it's not evenly distributed. And it's next to abject poverty. That's one. And then where the taboo second topic, of course, is Islam. And it doesn't allow the liberalization of society. It doesn't promote scientific research. It doesn't allow equality for women. It has certain reactionary elements within it that are violent. And it won't address the necessary changes in the modern world. So it has a resistance toward all the things that make modern societies wealthy: transparency, religious tolerance, constitutional government, the liberalization of women. It doesn't have that. And then three, it has a historical, I don't know how, it has historical burdens, so to speak. In the Islamic mind, this is a culture, pan-Islamic mind, I could say, and we saw little elements of that in the 60s and 70s with the unification of Libya and Egypt, the United Arab Republic and all that stuff. But there's an idea that one day, just maybe, in the future, there will be a pan-Islamic
caliphate. That was a dream of the sick dream of ISIS. And then all of the historical injustices that took El Andalus, Spain from Islam and stopped them at the gates of Vienna, all these crazy ideas will be rectified. And the Palestinians will destroy Israel and Islam will be in Europe again, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lot of people who believe that. And doesn't mean large percentages, but when you have about 700 million people and 10% believe it, you got 70 million fanatics. And so those governments that are illegitimate and are not constitutional or consensual, to stay in power, they make deals with these fanatics, whether it's the Saudi royal family, the Kuwaiti royal family, military governments in Syria or Libya, whatever it is, they allow those radicals to function and exist and even thrive by saying, point your guns or your terrorist bombs or your suicide vest at Westerners, not us. And we've allowed that to happen. And what I think is so ironic now is that when you want to be there and you want to say, please like us, and we're giving you billions of dollars in aid, and we took out Saddam, and we took out Gaddafi, and we took out the Taliban for you, it doesn't work. But when you say, been there, done that, see you, wouldn't want to be you, when you have that attitude, then all of a sudden it's, please, stay engaged, adjudicate the Turks and the Kurds, don't let all these people die in Afghanistan, look at Iraq, we have a functioning democracy, why would you abandon us, all this stuff. And so I think that's what Trump, with his animal cunning, has sensed. It is, build up the U.S. economy, build even stronger U.S. military forces, but you know, optional wars have bad optics and bad ratings, so don't get involved in them. And then let those SOBs beg us to come over at our convenience and our national interests and our self-interest. And that's where we are today. And everybody who says, oh, the bipartisan consensus of World War II, since World War II is crumbling and we need to be here, and Samantha Power, Hillary, you know, we came, we saw Gaddafi die, that's dead. It's got zero support. And I'm speaking as somebody who supported taking out Saddam Hussein, but there's just no support for that anymore, given the litany that you read and I wrote. It's just, we're tired of it.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.